Welcome to the Fat Fuel Family Podcast, where every week Danny and Maura Vega discuss topics that help families live a healthy and active lifestyle with their little ones, including nutrition and training, peaceful parenting, education, and mindset. To stay up to date, make sure to hit subscribe on this podcast and check out the blog at www.fatfuel.family. You can also find them on Facebook and Instagram at dannyvega.ms, at fatfueledmom, and at fatfueledkids, and Fat Fuel Family on YouTube. Enjoy the show.
Hey everyone, sorry for the interruption, but I have an exciting announcement I wanted to share with you. You all know how fond I am of the carnivore diet. I started it in August of 2017, and for the most part, in the past 3 years, I've stuck to it. I've teamed up with my great friend, Adam Scheible, host of the Million Pound Mission podcast, to create a course for any of you who are curious about the carnivore diet. It's called Couch to Carnivore, and this course covers the range of diets from low-carb to carnivore. You don't have to be following a ketogenic diet or even a low-carb diet to start. We take you through 7 phases from the standard American diet all the way to strict carnivore. Once you finish this course, you'll be armed with all the right information to decide which variation works best for you. In addition, we offer follow-along videos, recipe ideas, and all the great community building and support that Adam is known for. You can check that out at couchtocarnivore.com. That's couchtocarnivore.com. Welcome to the Fat Fuel Family Podcast. I'm your host, Danny Vega, and I'm joined by my carnivore wife today. How are you, my love? I didn't think that one through before.
Yeah. Hey, carnivore works since we're talking about beef. Yeah. So I'll take it.
Yeah. We're super excited because
I am a carnivore.
Yeah. 100%. Of course you are. You eat a lot more meat than a lot of guys I know. So
yeah, for sure.
Anyways, our guest this week is Kara Smith from Colorado Craft Beef. We're super excited to have her, guys. We're going to do a 3-week series with her, her husband, and then we're going to do a Q&A episode. So we really just wanted to give you guys a look into every aspect of the business. And then we're going to also get your questions and answer them on a third episode. So we definitely want as many questions as you guys want. Send them to hello@fatfuel.family. But first, let us tell you a little bit about Colorado Craft Beef and about the Smiths. So the land where their ranch is located was originally homesteaded in 1917 by Kara Smith's great-great-grandfather during the Enlarged Homestead Act of 1909. This is a family business at its core, and they're committed to building relationships with their suppliers and customers alike. Colorado Craft Beef takes pride in having lasting relationships within the beef cattle industry and providing their customers with the quality product that Colorado and all who enjoy their craft beef can be proud of. Their beef is raised in the sand hills of northeastern Colorado in an environment 5 generations rich in respect and passion for the land and animals they care for. Their mission is to not only provide consumers with a high-quality beef product, but to also engage with those who are unfamiliar with the importance of knowing their roles within the industry and in agriculture as a whole. They offer craft beef and grass-fed beef. Today, we're going to get into the differences between those two, as well as learn more about animal husbandry and the daily process. We hope to all learn more about this process so that we can have a greater appreciation of all that goes into the process of raising and harvesting the meat that we love. So without further ado, welcome to the show, Kara Smith. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here, Kara. Well, we always lead off with the question, what is the most critical problem you're currently trying to solve?
So I love this question. This is something that actually drove the conception of Colorado Craft Beef is just this. I've been in the ag industry, particularly the beef industry, my entire life. And so many things that we talk about is our current state of our consumer is about 4 generations removed from production ag right now. Wow. So there's just that kind of lack of connection of where our food comes from. So that piece of it was part of that critical problem of let's have some conversations around where our food comes from. Of course, for me in particular, it was beef and just really reconnecting the consumer with that. And then there was kind of a twofold problem within that is the beef industry has become very segmented over the years. That's not necessarily, I wouldn't call it a problem, but it's one of those challenges of how do we really connect all segments of our beef chain to provide a wonderful product for an end consumer, because we all have different resources that we need to manage. So how do we kind of manage through that, but still always keep our consumer in mind, is the other piece of really even where the conception of Colorado Craft Beef came from.
That makes so much sense. And I love your focus on education. It's all over your site. It's all over the conversations I've had with Jeff. And like, it's interesting to see, you talked about the segments, but even outside, from an outside view, it seems like there's this weird view of ranchers and cattlemen, and they get lumped in with big ag. And I laugh at that so much, because from my side of things, I don't know that much, but I will tell you that it doesn't seem like you all are fat cats. It's like there's a lot more grunt work and a lot more that people just don't know about. So that's really why we're here today. So we're going to talk about this side of the process, because a lot of us, like the city slickers, you talk about four generations. It's quite crazy how quickly we went from this group of people who had so much more appreciation for the process to now, where you have people buying their shrink wrapped beef from the store, and they shudder to even consider looking or learning about what goes into it. It's like, I want to eat it, but I don't want to know about it. And I think that's dangerous. So we want to learn about the day-to-day process, and we know that this is your wheelhouse. So, but first, can you give us a background on your ranch and your experience?
Sure. So the piece of ground that we ranch on, as you alluded to in the introductory, it actually was homesteaded in the Large Homestead Act. So within that, it's basically, it was originally a half a section, which is 320 acres, that my great-great-grandfather came out here and settled this piece of ground. And where we're headquartered is only a half a mile away from where the original homestead was. So it's kind of a neat thing to have that much history in one place. And in that, we've learned a lot about the land over, you know, well over 100 years now of being here, on how we best manage the land. And in that, of course, the cattle are a big piece of how we manage this piece of ground. But from my background, I've born and raised here. I'm fifth generation on this ranch. And our little girl, who's now about 8 months old, she's the sixth generation.
Oh, wow.
So that's the...
I love
yeah,
it.
Yeah, the history is a fun thing. But from the beginning, I've always known that I wanted to be a part of production ag, particularly beef cattle production. So going to high school here in Akron High School, after I graduated, I went to school in Texas. I did an undergrad in animal science, and then I went to grad school for ruminant nutrition, aka cow nutrition. And then I started working in industry after that up in Boise, Idaho, and then moved over actually into the animal health industry. And when my husband and I got the opportunity to move back closer to the ranch, we did so. We've been here for about 4 years now since then. So.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, we would love to learn more about what you do on a daily basis. Could you walk us through a typical day or a few typical days of what your responsibilities are?
Sure. So on the ranch, it really kind of depends on the time of year, really, what your day-to-day operation looks like. This time of year during the summer, everything is turned out to grass. So they're just out grazing to their heart content. We've got cattle all around us. We have very few neighbors, and we can see definitely more cows than we would people on a daily basis. So, but along with that is the daily welfare check of our animals. And all of that year is still done horseback. So we'll saddle up horses and check all of our pastures to make sure fences are good, make sure that our wells are working, because of course water is essential, and that's how all of our cattle are watered, is from well water. And that's something that has to be checked on a daily basis to make sure that they have plenty of water. And then we'll ride through the cattle and make sure that everything looks good as far as health goes from the respiratory side, but also checking their eyes and their feet and making sure that everything is still good and they're all happy and healthy. So that's this time of year, that's what it looks like. It varies a little bit. We want to start talking about fall and into the winter and some other times of year, it varies quite a bit. But this time of year, that's kind of the day-to-day process.
Yeah, we have friends up in Canada, and they were telling us, Tara, what's Tara's last name? Couture. Yeah. Tara Couture. She's up in, I forget where, it's in the middle or slightly west. And she was telling us about like the winter and how much their children were involved in the process, which we just like, we were fascinated by that because they learned about death. They learned about taking care of animals. And like, what does it look like? Like you talk about the wells and in the winter, how does that work? Because you got frozen stuff. How do you water them in the winter when you have freezing temperatures and things like that?
Yes, that brings another challenge. And at that point, you start getting your axe out because you've got to break water. So,
wow.
Yeah, that's a routine, unfortunately, but it's part of it. Is you got to make sure you break the ice so cattle can get to water. We do have some other places where we have, you know, enough heat source on some of our automatic waters that we don't have to do that.
Nice.
But you have to be close enough, of course, electricity to be able to do that. But some places, yeah, you just got to get your ice pick out and work away. So.
And you keep on bringing things up that just keep on spurring my curiosity. And I would love for you to talk a little bit about, we didn't think about this, but now I'm thinking of it. What is the type of, I'm sure you have an opinion on everything. And like we have strong opinions on things. And like, we think that's okay. Like if you're doing something a certain way where you are, it's for a reason. So I want to ask your opinion, knowing that it's how you do things at your ranch. But like, what should we be asking about when it comes to like, as consumers, like the feed over the winter months? Like, what are some of the things that we should be asking about with regards to the types of feed that people are using in those colder months?
Well, you make a good point, Danny, because different parts of the U.S., we have to manage that differently. Because, of course, yeah, we're in Colorado, and we do get a true winter. You know, we get snowfall and below, you know, sub-zero temperatures and things like that. But there's other parts of the U.S. where they can graze green grass year-round. They just have that ability to do that. But even that, grass values change throughout the year because they're not getting, you know, enough sunlight to produce as much nutrients. And there's times where we have to supplement cattle to make sure they have enough energy and protein and all of the necessities to keep them in good condition and those types of things. So it really kind of varies on where you are. But we, in this part of the world, we stockpile forage, which basically means we hay and we put up hay so we can feed that throughout the winter months because we don't have access to green grass because Mother Nature doesn't allow for it.
So basically hay is the main source, and that has more than enough, and I'm sure it's probably better for their digestive systems and some of these other things, right?
So it depends. It depends on the type of hay, on how much actual protein that we have, how it was put up. That's another part of ag, and we start building in the fact that farming also plays into how we can do what we can do in the beef cattle industry because of those types of things, of stockpiled forages. But we also can graze like residue crops. So in this area, we have a lot of corn, and there's a lot of cows that go out to corn stalks for the winter. So they'll graze those corn stalks. But in that, no matter what a producer's doing, they're managing the protein and the energy. And sometimes that does require supplementation with whether it's a protein tub or some other type of grain, just to make sure that we can keep our animals in the best condition as possible. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that with all of this, it comes down to an economic sustainability as well.
Yes.
Because we have access here to more corn, other grains, things like that than they would in some other parts of the world because they just don't grow them there.
Right.
So when we start managing that and looking at it from an economic aspect, that's a huge piece, especially in a beef cattle operation. I mean, that's our number one input cost is feed. Yeah. So that's
trying to make them more efficient, right? That's a big thing. I see a lot of papers written on increasing feed efficiency.
Yes. Yes. Feed efficiency is a huge piece of that. So, and for me at the heart of a ruminant nutritionist, got to make sure that they have a balanced diet too, and are getting everything that they need from all of their nutritional requirements.
So cool. It's so involved.
It's so involved. So can you tell us a little bit more about the differences between the cattle breeds and the process and how it differs between craft beef and grass-fed beef?
Sure. So let's start with the cattle breeds. In the U.S., we have two primary, you know, buckets that I'd say that we put our cattle breeds into. We have continental cattle breeds and we have British cattle breeds. So the continental, for example, would be like a Charolais. That's or a Simmental or a Limousine. Those are larger framed cattle. They typically have more muscle than fat. And then on the opposite side of that, we have our British breeds. So that would be like Hereford, Angus, those types of breeds. Mm-hmm. They're typically shorter statured, typically have the propensity to have more fat versus just sheer muscle, and you just a smaller structure type comparatively.
Gotcha. And I again, this is for as much of an educational experience for us as it is for the listeners.
Yeah.
So like if we say something that was coming from ignorance, it's just pure ignorance. But like I did see recently that there's been this effort in, I believe, the UK and maybe some other countries around the world that are trying to reproduce like Wagyu, for instance. Is that something that is inherently good or bad? Are those cattle treated well? I don't know much about it. I just know it's delicious, but okay. I don't know much else about it.
Sure. So Wagyu is definitely a completely different breed. And in that, they do have that genetic propensity to marble like they do. And of course, that's why it makes delicious beef, as it has that higher percentage of fat in it comparatively. And it's eclectic to that particular breed. And even in the States, there are quite a few producers that have been looking at that kind of more niche type market. Because when we start talking from a Wagyu of the actual cattle side, they're typically a smaller framed animal and their birth weights are incredibly low. So there's a lot of producers that start putting Wagyu bulls on their like first calf Angus heifers, because those calves are so much smaller. So it makes their calving ease that much better. Yes. So that's been kind of a nice use for that breed. But just in general, yeah, we have seen more of that, because they do have incredibly high quality beef that comes from that breed. But most of the time here, Wagyu is typically crossed on one of our British breeds, like an Angus would be the most common. But I've seen it across the board when people start crossing them on other types of breeds and things like that. So it does happen here as well as in the UK.
I feel like I'm hogging this, my love, but I keep on getting more questions that I just have to ask.
Okay, but so, wait, because I wanted her to talk about like the craft, like what
makes the craft side of it. Good call.
Because your company name, Colorado Craft Beef, people might not understand. I know I didn't understand the difference. Can you just let us know and our listeners? Yeah, the difference between craft and grass-fed.
Sure. So with the craft side, I kind of start from the beginning with that of we really are crafting a beef experience from the beginning, but we start with whether it's bull selection, different things like that, to really kind of gear an animal the best we can to our environment. So you kind of moderating the cow size, making sure that we're getting more of these British type breeds, because we know that they have a higher propensity to marble and have a really flavorful, you know, steak at the end of the day. So that's part of that craft story. But also my husband, Jeff, he has quite a few contacts within the ag industry, particularly the feed and grain industry. So in that with the craft finishing story is we're utilizing a lot of byproducts within our area and our region that have been utilized in the past, but also maybe not in this kind of, you know, niche type market. So if you want to think about associating craft beef with craft beer, in some ways, it is very similar. We're utilizing some of these other products that may have not necessarily been used, feeding them in our cattle rations to gear a product for an end consumer, and also just tying in that sustainability story, but tying in the relationships that we have with some of these other segments of the industry. For example, we're utilizing some spent brewer grains in the past, and there's a craft malting company up on the Front Range that we utilize their byproducts and feed that into our cattle rations. So it's kind of the story on how we tie in so much more of ag, especially in this area, because Colorado is rich on all types of ag. So we can utilize quite a few different types of feed and feed ingredients. We also have a farmer neighbor that grows flax. We've used that in cattle rations before as well. So those are just kind of some examples on how we're crafting that diet for cattle.
Well, I can't imagine, because like, number one, it seems like a very regional experience, like you would with craft beef, which would give it that flavor. And then you start thinking about flax and the amount of soluble fiber in that could really, whatever that the magic that exists within that cow, where it lives and its genetics, like how the actual taste comes out from what they're doing when they're growing up. I mean, I can see that. And then I love that you mentioned spent grains, because that's another one that I think that's using more of what a lot of people throw away. And I just love the idea of that, of being able to, like, it's a much more sustainable use, because I mean, spent grains, is that like a common thing that people are putting into their feed?
It can be. Yes. It's been done commercially before, as of course we're not very far from Coors here and now outside of Golden. and they have quite a bit of spent brewer's grains, of course, that come out of there on a daily basis. And the majority of that is going into cattle feed. So right. It is a pretty cool story of being able to utilize some of these byproducts to put that into a ruminant animal that then creates it into the highest quality protein. So
I love it. All right. And so this is goes into like this other question that I think a lot of people should look into, because we just had a friend who is passionate about sustainable farming and passionate about meat, but she's also really passionate about telling people to go learn more, because this whole grass-fed versus grain-fed thing, like she asked Rob Wolf a question on a Q&A and he had a great answer about like, let's not let perfect get in the way of people doing really, really well. And we dismiss them because that there's some grain in their diet or they're not grass finished. And there seems to be a lot of confusion and this, even an air of like elite thinking when it comes to cattle health. For example, I mentioned grass fed versus grass finished, antibiotics, a lot of things that people who don't know much about this, they may think some of these things are necessary, like don't do antibiotics ever, no matter what. And we learned just from talking with people involved in dairy that it's not that simple. For example, like if a cow gets sick, how are you going to protect the rest of the cows? So can you help us understand this a little better? And maybe if there's any myths that you hear a lot online, because everybody puts out cute little graphics and everything looks so pretty, but it's coming from a place of ignorance. And like you told us your bona fides, you told us your credibility and your background. And I think I'd rather listen to someone like you than an influencer or someone online who may not know much about it at all.
Sure. So I think that's a great point, Danny. Yeah, there is a lot of misconceptions, unfortunately, with ag in general, but what people are feeding their families. And we've seen this terrible negative trend of that negative marketing of eat ours because the other is bad because of this. Yeah. And we don't agree with that. We don't want to see the negative marketing. And that's something that we're very adamant about as a company of, we're not going to demonize the rest of the industry just so we can get ahead. That's just something that, you know, that's a no-go for us. And in that, unfortunately, when we start saying these things of these things are bad, or we tell a mother that she has to buy organic, natural, so on and so forth, and you tell me whatever label claim it may be, because it's better for her and her family. And she you know, maybe couldn't afford to buy the conventional beef, and I don't necessarily like that term, but you know, the conventional beef that's at the supermarket that is a perfectly good product and it's safe and it's nutritious, but yet she feels like that she can't because we've demonized that product. That's just not right, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So there's so many of these things that have kind of gotten misconstrued. The antibiotic deal is one of them. Of any rancher I know that's worth his weight in salt, and you know, I know quite a few of them, they wouldn't deliberately do anything to harm their cattle. That's just something that wouldn't happen.
Yeah. I mean, not only I hate how people do that, even like when the vegans, they always show, like, a lot of the time it's like stuff going on in third world countries and places that don't have the regulations that we have, and all of a sudden it's perfect. Let's demonize all meat because of that.
Right. Yes. And that's just a travesty, unfortunately, because you know, beef is, and of course, most in my opinion, but the highest quality protein that's available. And when we start saying that you can't buy this because of X, Y, and Z, I don't agree with that. That is
good for you. Yeah. That's good. We agree too.
Yeah, we agree with that.
We always make the joke like it's better to have grain fed beef than to have organic quinoa. That's just how we look at it.
Yes, right. Right. Well, because, because we get a lot of people who do have that issue and they want to eat healthy and they want to do what we do, but maybe they can't afford grass-fed meat all the time. I'm like, it's much better
to eat the meat that you like,
the best quality meat that you can afford.
And you can afford, yeah.
And I think you'd still be better off. So, go ahead.
To your guys' point on the grass-fed side, if we want to delve into that for just a minute.
Oh yeah.
That's kind of interesting nomenclature that's kind of taken hold of that like value proposition of this is better because of this.
Right.
And before probably about the 1970s, about 100% of our beef in the US was 100% grass-fed, grass-finished.
Right.
You know, that was the production chain we were in, and still other countries it is because they have access to green grass all year and, you know, we're able to do that. But we made a shift in the U.S. to more of the grain finish because we had adequate grains and we could do that. And we think about the amount of time that it takes to get cattle to your plate and beef, it shortens that window significantly. So when we start talking about some other factors of we don't have as much land in the U.S. as we used to have cattle 100% free roaming, free grazing all year round. And we just don't have access to the green growing grass year round, especially in, you know, the northern tier of the states. But it's with the grain finishing, you know, we're basically just increasing the caloric density of the diet and shortening that window that it takes for an animal to get to their biological endpoint. But with cattle, I tell this to a lot of people that may not come from the industry, cattle, their superpower is converting grass to the high quality protein that they do. You know, that's what the rumen is geared for, and it allows them to do that. The pork and poultry industry, they aren't able to do that because they don't have a rumen. They're a simple stomach animal. So what comes in goes out. We basically, in a ruminant, we're feeding those bugs that live in their rumen. And those bugs, they adapt to what we feed them, whether it's grass or a more heavily kind of concentrated diet. They adapt accordingly. And then they allow that animal to take in the amount of calories that they are. But there's so many arid parts of the world, and ours is one of those. We're more vast grazing land, and cattle give us the ability to produce protein off of that we wouldn't be able to with other species and different things like that. But
wow. Yeah. Thank you for explaining that. That makes so much sense. Let's talk a little bit about the sourcing. So what does the sourcing of cattle look like, and what should consumers know about this?
Well, one of the things that we talked about to begin with was one of those kind of critical problems. And in that, our beef chain is very segmented. So all the way from a cow-calf operator that's what they do is they raise calves. They have the cow herd. But then you have a middle sector of our industry that we talk about is called a backgrounder or a stalker, which is kind of more that grazing, that intermediate part of the industry. And then we go into if something's grain finished into a feed yard sector, and then on to the packer or whoever produces that animal into a beef product. And in that, compared to some other industries, there is a massive amount of capital that goes into all of these different segments of the chain. And beef cattle take a lot longer to get to where they can become beef than a chicken or a pig does. Their life cycle is much longer. So being able to carry an animal all the way from when they are born to when they become beef is a pretty big ask as far as capital expenditure. And that's just on the live cattle side. And then you start talking about the economic resources that would need to go into producing them into beef of a harvest facility and different things like that. Basically, that's caused our industry to be pretty segmented. And along those lines, every producer, they ranch on a different piece of ground that may be more geared for a particular segment than some others. So from the cow-calf sector to where you need to carry those mama cows until they're, from the time they're born until they're maybe 12 years old, depending on how long they stay in your herd, that takes a different, you know, piece of ground and economic resources than somebody that might be able to kind of function in those two center pieces of our beef chain. So in that, long story short, we try to tie all of those together the best we can without, you know, saying that we need to own 100% everything from cradle to grave, for lack of a better term, because there are ranchers that we partner with that deal in this or that kind of target their operation the same way we do on philosophies and how cattle are raised and genetics and so on and so forth with what we do here and all the way through the end of that chain. So those are different things that we look at across our industry and how we best let each individual segment of the beef chain function the best that it possibly can for the ground they have and the resources that they have available.
So it seems like from what you're saying that we're seeing the same, because I've seen a lot lately in the past, let's say 5 to 10 years, on how agriculture has gotten too segmented. There's definitely, from what you're saying, a lot of benefits to having that specialization of labor, that division of labor. But then there's when you have too much segmentation, it seems like there's no working knowledge, there's no skill set where maybe before there was, because people are like, look, I'm a corn farmer, I'm a this farmer. But what you're saying is basically that you guys balance, you guys take the advantages that you get from the division of labor, and then as well as still kind of looking at more of a holistic operation. Does that sound accurate?
Yes. Yeah, that would be a good summation, because we definitely have become very segmented in agriculture for good reason, as far as doing what we do the best that we can. But also sometimes it may get geared a little further away from the end product that we are all producing as ranchers, and that's beef. So we all want to keep that in mind at the end of the day, that really that is what we're producing. Whether we're a rancher that has 100 head of cows and he sells steers and heifers in the fall, I really, yes, that is your commodity. But at the end of the day, what's really driving that value is beef, because that's what we're producing.
Makes perfect sense. So this next question from me is again, we don't understand the cattle industry much, but what we've heard is, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but we've heard that it seems like cattlemen and ranchers don't have as much power as the meat packers. And a lot of the time this leads to issues for them, maybe less autonomy, less ability to make the decisions they want to make. So like, what are the challenges that you guys face? And what do you think we can do as consumers to support our cattlemen?
You bet. So That is a very kind of hot button topic right now, especially.
No, we don't want to piss off any meat packers. So
no, it's more just what we've just been through with COVID. I mean, we realized how fragile our supply chains really are. Our phone was ringing off of the hook in the midst of COVID because people that typically normally have gone to the grocery store and purchased their meat that way, they went to the store and realized that there wasn't any meat there. And that was kind of a scary thing. And in that, you know, we realized that our supply chains in the beef industry maybe are more fragile than we thought they were. So it's been an interesting time in that. And we're still working through that because even with these large packers, and I could speak for Colorado just because of where we are, and there is large packing capacity here, but we've been really backed up because they weren't able to harvest cattle because of COVID. So that's been a huge challenge, and still is out there within our industry on how we manage through that. We were a little bit different in our segment just because it's more of a smaller kind of niche. We aren't sending cattle to these large processors. We have a smaller regional processor that we utilize. But that even that dynamic changed in the midst of COVID and how we schedule cattle to be harvested for beef and project that and get our cattle into beef to go to a consumer. So that's an interesting concept right now. But in that, especially if consumer wants to know exactly where their meat comes from and be able to pick up the phone and call the person who raised it, they can support their local rancher. Give them a call and see if they sell beef directly to them versus going through some of the other channels. So that's always an option. But at the end of the day, across the board, consumers help support ranchers by eating beef, whatever kind of beef it is. So
that's a great, great point. And we spoke to our local guy. He's not a rancher, but he does have pigs and chickens and ducks and all that. And then he gets his beef from, there's like about an hour away from us where it comes from. And I asked him because he lost about 40% of his business from all the wholesale to the restaurants when the restaurants closed. But crazy, he is doing better than ever because he was able to take advantage, maybe because he already had a good system. And maybe some people probably didn't have that in place, the direct to consumer. They didn't look at all the holes in their supply chain. It seems like it's probably easier with chicken and pork. You could correct me if I'm wrong. Maybe it's because of the quicker turnover, but is that something that you would say, like it's a little bit easier with chicken and pork or is it probably the same? I don't know how it works with processing versus meat, because meat is a lot of the time you're talking about a massive animal, different cuts. I just don't know. Like, is there any differences between these other animals and beef as it pertains to like the supply chain?
There would be. And in that, because the majority of, you know, the pork that we consume as well as poultry, it comes from vertically integrated operations. So they're owned all the way through by the same person. And typically it's the packer. So our industry, our beef industry, is really one of the only ones that's left, you know, on a mass scale that doesn't have that kind of vertical integration. So that makes for a different type of supply chain comparatively to the other proteins that are out there. Because even with these large packers owning the animals all the way through, they could manage through that a little bit different than like our chain of one person owns the calves and then they sell them to a stocker and then they sell them to a feed yard. And then the feed yard sells them to a packer. There's many steps of that chain comparatively. So there's a little bit more room for a shakeup within that.
And with these regional meat packers, has there been any more of an increase as far as like working closer with the cattlemen? I just don't see, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't see a lot of cattlemen who have that seems like the magic thing. And I don't know if it's a finance issues, like people don't even understand, like the margins on beef are not great at all. I know because I wanted to create this product that was, I make these organ meat burgers and every child, every human that tries them loves them. And I was like, well, I'm going to make this organ meat burger and I'm going to do this. And then I learned about the USDA process and I learned about the refrigeration and the shipping and all that stuff. And it was like, nope, no thanks. I'll give you guys a recipe. But it's just like one of those things, like little old me couldn't, conceptualize, or even I didn't want to get into the whole process because the margins are already so small. And then the minimum order quantities for things are never going to be good for me because it's the amount of capital needed. So is there any innovation going on with the packers and the cattlemen working closer together, or like merges or anything like that?
I would say, especially from what we've seen as far as COVID kind of seeing some of the holes within our supply chain, there has been much more talk and push of looking at some more smaller regional type harvest plants versus just the larger processors that are out here, that are out across the US in general. There has been quite a bit of talk about that, on how we can do that a little bit better within our beef chain. But you alluded to some really key points there. The amount of capital that it requires to run a harvest facility is incredible. And then at the end of the day, especially with beef, but all proteins, you have to look at how you utilize the entire animal, which becomes yes. really difficult. And a lot of times in our chain, that can, of course, our export markets are huge for that. And some of the products that we don't use in the US, and that can be the margin that a producer needs, especially say if they're feeding cattle or something like that, comparatively, because it is an interesting concept. Yeah. And it's a total different side of the business when you start getting into meat versus the live cattle side. The capital and resources that are needed are completely different. But there has been more talk on maybe some smaller, more regional plants, how we do that so we can ensure that we can harvest cattle. But that is a hinge pin of the business, because that's how we have to convert cattle into beef, is we have to go through that process. And like you mentioned, we have to have those USDA standards to make sure that our food safety is where it needs to be. And this, the infrastructure to be able to do that, especially with a large number and a large animal like beef cattle, it's quite a bit different, because some of the other protein sectors, they can do really well in automating their harvest process because most of their animals are very similar size. Our beef chain is not like that. So we still require quite a bit of labor within these harvest facilities to manually do the harvest process, because we can't do a whole lot of automation because not all of our cattle are exactly the same size.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if this is something better for Jeff, but I'm going to ask it anyways, because my libertarian side is going to come out now. And I'll tell you that in other industries, what I see is that regulation tends to be less about protecting the consumer and more about this financial transaction. And a lot of the times in other industries, you see that more regulation equals just like, it's a big way to keep out the little guy. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are, like with regards to regulation. Are we just right where we need to be? Are there things that we should change to ease the process without the risk of tainting the meat or anything like that? Because like I said, a lot of the time it's all about labels. Like when I first got this butcher book, it was like the whole beef butcher or the whole animal butcher, something like that. And I learned so much about all these labels and what a joke they are, and how it's just like, it's so much, it's all about money. And we, as keto people, low carb people, we know to look at the back of a package. We know that the front of the package is all marketing and the back of the package is where the real meat pun intended, is. So what are your thoughts on like the state of the regulatory process? And like, are there things that you think that maybe we can advocate for, as we're not lobbyists, but we can definitely write a letter, we can just increase awareness? Are there any blind spots or any areas where you think we can be making noise about to hopefully ease the process for you as a cattleman?
Sure. Well, here's a great example, Danny. So the organic label for a topic of conversation, all of our ground could be certified organic. I mean, we've never sprayed anything on it. I mean, it's 100% organic. There is no question about it. But the amount of money that it would cost for us to be third-party verified to say that our ground is 100% organic is pretty cost prohibitive. I mean, it's pretty crazy to do that. In essence, we can have a conversation with our consumer and say, yes, if you're concerned about the organic label, we are organic. We run on organic ground, instead of having to go through all the process that, like you mentioned, costs additional dollars to be officially third-party verified, certified organic, or whatever you put the label in there. But that's what Jeff and I normally, we tell our customers or anybody that's interested. We're like, if you want to know these things, if they're important to you and your family, call us and ask us, versus just we've gotten so big within the protein sectors, especially now, you know, really most of the beef in the US is controlled by four packers at the most, unless you're buying from a local rancher, things like that. And that's kind of their way of showing that transparency, for lack of a better term, of these things have been verified all the way through the chain. And basically, it's just increasing the cost for a consumer at the end of the day, because those costs need to come from somewhere. And they do come from somewhere, versus just the fact that you're a rancher and you feel good about what they do and you can ask them these questions that are important to you. That's great. I think that's a good example of that additional cost and kind of regulation that we've built into it. And it sounds like you have experience on those kind of regulations and maybe some of the backdoor to the USDA type of certifications. And that happens kind of across the board. Like, for example, natural, when we talk about that in the live cattle industry, that means that they haven't had any growth promotants and they haven't had any antibiotics. However, on a beef package, natural means minimally processed, no artificial ingredients. So we have a big discrepancy there what they're asking of the live cattle industry and how to certify that, which has the costs and all the things that go with it, versus the fact that we could label any of our whole meat cuts natural because they're whole cuts. They're minimally processed, no artificial ingredients. So that's probably a long-winded answer to your question, but those are some kind of examples of where additional regulation may not necessarily be a good thing and just increases costs at the end of the day, versus providing the transparency that most consumers are after.
I love that you said it, because what we always say, again, it goes back to our libertarian roots, is that we, for example, the cool laws, and I know that his name's Will something, he's from White Oak Pastures, and he wrote an article about how before they're big on regenerative farming, and he was beating that drum and telling everybody, you can convert your operation. It's going to take a couple of years. You're going to lose some margin, but eventually you can get back to where you were. But now he said that nowadays it's so hard to do that when these companies that are sending beef throughout the United States are buying it from New Zealand and buying it from South America. It's super cheap. It's grass fed. We can bring it over here. And as long as it's inspected here, it's a product of the USA and all that stuff. And so he was advocating for a change in the laws. And I remember sharing his article, and I said, I took issue with that one part. I said, I totally agree that people should know about where their meat comes from, but instead of advocating for more regulations, which there's always a gimme, there's always a catch, and it's always like the person with the most money is at the table, versus what we've always said, which is call your farmer, call your rancher. They're dying to tell you all about what they do. They love what they do. And so we're glad that you said that, because we totally agree.
You bet.
Awesome. Well, this has been a great first episode first of three to our series. Where can people find out more about you and what you're doing online?
So the best way would either be our website, coloradocraftbeef.com, or we are active on all social media channels. We stay really active on Instagram in particular, so at Colorado Craft Beef, but we also do have a Facebook page and Twitter as well.
Great.
Amazing. And I'm just going to say one last thing, just in case people forgot, is that we're going to open this up for questions, because we're going to do three episodes with the Smith family. So you guys just met Kara. And next week, you'll meet Jeff and you'll learn a different side of the business. And then we'll do a final Q&A episode with them answering all of your questions. So please send any and all questions to hello@fatfuel.family. And also, if you'd like to try Colorado Craft Beef, our discount code is FatFueledFam. I'll tell you guys, it's a different experience. I'll tell you that right now. It's delicious. We need to get some more. We haven't gotten some in a while, so we're going to order some right now for ourselves. And right now, for Kara, you guys heard what the topic was. So animal husbandry, cattle health, all of the things that we spoke about with Kara, we'd love to hear your questions, because we're going to collect them. We're going to compile them together. And like I said, in a few weeks, we'll be doing the Q&A episode, which will just go even deeper. So thank you so much, Kara. We really appreciate your time. And is there anything else that you think we've missed? Or if not, I mean, we're grateful for you spending your time with us.
No, I greatly appreciate the opportunity. You know, this is one of those things that we've talked about in the cattle industry since I've been in it, is how we do really engage with consumers and give them the view of what we do every day and increase that confidence in the product that we produce, which is beef.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think it's weird that we give so much leeway to clinical studies in the, for example, in the pharmaceutical sector, and nobody bats an eye at the fact that it's being funded by pharma. Yet for some reason, when we produce, it's like, why aren't people sharing more of these? There's tons of beef studies. You can open up any of these periodicals that go to the cattlemen that are people in industry. For some reason, I don't know why they don't share that, because they think that it's funded by the beef industry. Well, of course it's funded by the beef industry. There's, who else is going to fund it? It's just weird how you guys don't get the same leeway.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Really we have a nationwide checkoff that funds a high percentage of that research. So, yeah. It is funded by ranchers at the end of the day.
Which is amazing. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's how we, how else are they going to fund themselves? Their needs, everything in life is built on incentives. If there's no incentive to fund research that's going to look deeper into it and teach people more, then we're just not going to get it.
Sure.
So thank you again, Kara. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you both.
Hey guys, we're going to take a minute right now to tell you about one of our amazing sponsors, Santa Cruz Medicinals. Santa Cruz Medicinals is a company that we've been using for years now. They make high potency, high quality, lab tested CBD formulas at an affordable price. They offer ketogenic, paleo, gluten-free, sugar-free, lab tested formulas.
You all may remember when we did our cannabis series last year. One of the things we learned with CBD is that the research is pretty clear on dosage. 5 to 20 grams per kilogram is what you should be taking per day. And most of the quote-unquote CBD you see online and on Amazon is severely underdosed. Most of these products are offering dosages that are so low, you have to down a bottle a day. That's why we love Santa Cruz Medicinals, because they offer highly dosed, potent CBD with clean ingredients, and they have several cool products, but we want to share our favorites with you. So what are your favorites, my love?
All of them? No, really. I have yet to try a product from them that I don't love. However, I will talk about some of my ride or die products. So during my cycle, I get horrible migraines, guys. And my go-to is definitely their peppermint tincture or the 10,000 milligrams to get a potent anti-inflammatory dose. Peppermint has been shown in studies to relieve migraine pain. But let's talk about the pain salve real quick, because this I use for almost everything. And everyone in this household agrees we cannot live without it. So the CBD pain salve, it has clean ingredients that you can trust, but it also has peppermint, which really, really helps. And so what I like to do is I'll rub some on my temples, and it really provides instant relief for me when I have bad headaches. But of course, I'll use it as well for any muscle pain that I have.
Well, I'm personally a huge fan of the 10,000 milligram bottles of CBD in MCT oil. I put it in my coffee, and then again at night, I'll put some more in, like some broth or whatever drink I'm drinking, a hot tea, to get an adequate dose for the day. I also love the pain salve, especially when I'm extra sore. We usually take turns massaging it onto each other, and it always does the job. You guys also have to try the new CBD-infused hemp and collagen protein. If you're a fan of horchata, you will love this one.
Oh, that one is so good, guys. We just tried it, and it is so good. So yeah, if you're interested, check them out. You can find them at scmedicinals.com. And of course, don't forget to use the code FatFueledMom at checkout to save 15% on your order and get free shipping, guys.
So hard with a fake ass shoe. I'm too live, take that dive. Got my rhymes, but I feel LeBron. Yeah, whoa. Climate change, not my fault. Trying to stop on my sauce. I cannot fade, this is too late. Home of the same, yeah, yeah. How many cars, how many bras? Two for your heart, yeah, yeah. Up in the deep, what is you seeking? What is you peeping? We not so heathen, yeah. Never wanna dance all night. Scope on sight. Oh, you thought we won't fight. I don't lie, yeah. Climate change, don't need lames. I need God. I make the sauce. I mean, yeah. Glory to God. Shooters aim. I got range. What are the odds? Devil go. We not the same. No, we not. Climate change, don't need lames. I need God. I make the sauce. I mean, yeah. Glory to God. Give me the turn. Watch it burn. Get to the top, whoa, ooh, dang. I'm feeling myself, I had to go and count these buckets. They count me out cause now I'm stunting. Whoa, hey, day, we pull out a stick. God, we said, go let it hit. God, we said, get him, I got him. Oh, I know the option, I spot him. Oh, huh. I got epiphany, my bro. That one was steal from me, my bro. Listen, go see to me, but play with it. He kill and seek destroy. Yeah. Fight that fight for me. Haters gon' hate like whoop. Shake them off like this. I could have shown like
climate change, don't need lames. I need God. I make the sauce, I mean yeah. Glory to God. Shooters aim, I got range. What are the odds? Never go, we not the same. No, we not. Climate change, don't need lames. I need God. I make the sauce, I mean yeah. Glory to God. Give me the turn, watch it up burn.
You'll get far. Either that or your pocket in the car. I did it for the kids like LeVar. Talking wild about a family ball. Hey boy, please chill. Why you keep it so real? Got the whole room laughing. And your face blue still. All that comes with the press is the pressure. So much for a deal. My boy just got rich.
broke in with a meal. I feel your pain, forget the fame. I feel the flames, known from the climate change. You running?
Climate change, don't eat lames. I need God. I make the sauce, I mean, yeah, glory to God.